Coming up today on The Balanced Word.
People who continue to involve themselves in blatant sin that they know God forbids, and yet they think they're getting away with it. It's in your heart thinking that God's not really there. And so I think for all of us, it's important for us to ask ourselves, how often is the existence of God really in my heart? Am I really feeling Him there motivating me, leading and guiding me? Or, in fact, is my heart just kind of doing whatever it wants to do? And the existence of God and His presence, well, it's a long ways away from me.
Wake up, my soul. Wake up early in the day. Wake up, my hand. And the instrument I play. Wake up, my voice. Let the world hear me say, you are worshipped and exalted here today.
Pacific Hills Calvary Chapel welcomes you now to The Balanced Word, online at thebalancedword.com. Pastor Dave Rolfe is developing his study of the Psalms, and today we'll camp out in Psalm 14. It's foolish to say in your heart there is no God, but before we quote that to our unbelieving friends, we might want to consider whether or not we're living like there is no God in some area of life. Here's Pastor Dave to have us think that through.
Psalm 14 begins, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." We've quoted this often. For some people, this is all they need for apologetics when they run into an atheist. If someone says, "Oh, I don't believe in God," well, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. I've used it, but it's never really worked very well. I haven't led many people to the Lord by calling them a fool. It's certainly foolish to believe that there isn't a God. There's no doubt about that. But I think this passage is aiming itself at more than just atheists. If you take a closer look, you realize it's the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And I think if we're honest, a lot of times we live as practical atheists. It's not saying it with your mouth and saying, "Oh, I don't think there's a God." Yeah, that's definitely foolish. But so many times when we live our lives in such a way that we think God isn't looking, that's foolish. And we put ourselves into that category. People who continue to involve themselves in blatant sin that they know God forbids, and yet they think they're getting away with it. It's in your heart thinking that God's not really there. And so I think for all of us, it's important for us to ask ourselves, how often is the existence of God really in my heart? Am I really feeling Him there motivating me, leading and guiding me? Or, in fact, is my heart just kind of doing whatever it wants to do? And the existence of God and His presence, well, it's a long ways away from me. But he goes on to say people who, you know, in their hearts are living like there is no God. They're corrupt. They've done abominable works. There is none who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek God. They have all turned aside. They have together become corrupt. There is none who does good, no, not one. See, again, he starts out by talking about, oh, those people who say in his heart there is no God and how corrupt they are. But then he says, wait a minute. When it comes right down to it, how much good is in your heart? How much of God's leading and guiding is actually motivating what you do? And so it's not just that evil atheist that he's addressing himself to, but it's anyone who's incapable of being righteous on their own. And that means all of us. The truth is, there is none that doeth good, no, not one. There's a concept in theology called the depravity of man. It really basically means that we're kind of born evil, and that tendency of the flesh remains with us until we are delivered from this flesh. Now, theologically, some people take that concept to an extreme that would say that you're so depraved that you can't even turn to the Lord when he calls you, or that you can't even decide to accept Jesus Christ. And certainly the Bible doesn't teach that. That's a wrong teaching from the depravity of man. But the truth is, we are all depraved. When we point our finger at other people out there and say how depraved they are, we're missing that obvious thing that we have a lot in common with those evil people, with those depraved people. When I look at someone else's sin, I just have to say, there before the grace of God is where I would be. It's only God's work in my life that has softened that depravity in my heart enough that I can start to learn, I can begin to grow, I can start to develop. And it's so important that we as believers not live our lives in such a way that we pretend like we aren't depraved, that we're really good people, not like those evil people out there. Hey, we're all in the same boat. And when God looks at people apart from the work of Jesus Christ, he looks and he says, none of you guys are measuring up. Now, again, depravity doesn't mean that you can't do anything good. But the idea is, when it comes down to what you can do that can save yourself or help yourself, self-reformation doesn't cut it. Oh, there are people who don't know the Lord who do isolated good things, certainly. And sometimes we find ourselves doing good things almost accidentally. It just happens that way. But the point of the psalm is, you're not going to find a righteous person by looking around and finding who they are. That we are all sinners. And if it wasn't for the grace of God, we would all be condemned to hell. There's nothing that we can do to save ourselves. There's nothing that we can do that would merit anything really with God. There isn't any way that we can establish a righteousness that will give us some sort of standing before God. Now, thank God we don't have to look at ourselves apart from God. Praise God, because of the work that Jesus Christ did for us on the cross, we actually are righteous. We're declared righteous by God himself, justified by grace through faith. And so this is a reminder for those of us who have accepted Jesus Christ, just remember who you would be if God hadn't saved you. Sometimes when I baptize people, I'll explain baptism to them, and if they've accepted the Lord fairly recently and they're adults, it's easy for them to get their teeth into the concept that the old you is dead. The person that you used to be, it's being buried, and there's a new life that God is giving to you. But sometimes when I baptize a kid, it's hard to get that concept across. 6 or 7-year-old kid can't ever remember not loving God and submitting to him and believing in him, and now they're being baptized. And I will often tell them, you know, I thank God that you've always known him and that you've been raised understanding how much God loves you. But what baptism is about is that there's a person that you could have become. There's a person that you might have been, that the devil would want you to become. And that person, before it ever even develops, we're burying it. You're never going to become that sinful person. The truth is, for all of us, many of us look back at things we've done that were sins and lay them at the foot of the cross. But we also have to put in the equation all of the things that we would have done if we thought we could get away with it, all of the things that we might have done if we had had the opportunity, and all the things that we could have fallen into had not the Lord snatched us out of the pit of hell and given us that eternal life. And so we're all in this boat together. There is none who does good, no, not one. And he goes on to describe them a little more. Have all the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call on the Lord? There they are in great fear, for God is with the generation of the righteous. You shame the counsel of the poor, but the Lord is his refuge. Oh, that the salvation of Israel would come out of Zion. When the Lord brings back the captivity of his people, let Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad. It's interesting that when he starts talking about iniquity, starts talking about what you do when you're not walking with God, when you're not walking in his forgiveness, he doesn't immediately talk about some of the sins that we might brand as being, okay, here are the bad ones. But it's interesting that he says, these workers of iniquity with no knowledge eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call on the Lord. Two things. The very first one that he points out is people who use other people. People who do things to consume other people. The idea of of eating them up like you would eat bread is people are just a means to an end for me. They're people that I step on to get where I'm headed. They are just an opportunity for me to take advantage of. And this is something that God takes very seriously, and I suspect we don't take it as seriously as we should when we consider the horrible sins. It's interesting, sometimes people get so upset if they hear of someone stealing money from God, embezzling money from a church, or taking up money pretending that it's for relief efforts from the hurricane, and in reality it's just to pad one's own pocket. And we sometimes look at some of the people in the media who use, well, as Paul said, sign of a false prophet. They see godliness as a means to gain. They're trying to cash in, or like Peter said, making merchandise of the people, being a false prophet. And we rightfully get upset when we think of that. But sometimes I think that we feel like the worst thing you can do is to take some of God's money. The truth is, and believe me, I'm all for being very responsible with God's money, and it's a horrible sin to steal from God, certainly. The Lord points that out in Malachi, among other places. But I think sometimes we take very lightly something that's much more serious to God, and that is doing things that hurt people, using people, taking advantage of them, being abusive toward them. It's something that God takes very personally. And to him, money, gold, he uses it for asphalt in heaven. That's not the most valuable thing to him. It's one of the least valuable things to God, most likely. The only reason God makes a big deal about money is because he knows it means a lot to us. And so he calls us to give our money to him so that we'll show that we aren't connected to it, addicted to it. But the truth is, the people around you, the people in your lives, if you mistreat them, you're acting like an atheist. You're acting like someone who doesn't really have the heart of God. And in your heart, you are saying, there's no God. Because God says, I will stick up for those people that you're hurting. And if you convince yourself that that isn't happening, you're living like an atheist. I believe that God gets most upset when his people are injured by other people. And he'll come to their defense. He will. He doesn't take that lightly at all. And again, eating up my people and not calling on the Lord, not submitting to him, not taking our orders from him. He also says that in verse 6 that you shame the counsel of the poor. You think the poor don't have anything to offer you. You think you can't learn anything from them. But the Lord is his refuge. Now, there isn't anything spiritual about being poor, nor anything unspiritual about being rich. But they just aren't connected. There are very righteous people who are very wealthy. There are very righteous people who are very poor. And there are very pathetic, ungodly people who are rich and some who are poor. But our world tends to believe that the ones who attain material success, they must be the good guys. They must be the godly. And the ones who haven't, well, there's a reason why, because they're just not in submission to the Lord. They're not walking with the Lord. And so he makes it clear that a person who takes advantage of other people, they don't have much to do with the poor because they feel like, what can they do for us? We don't want to reach out to the poor because, come on, if you get a million of them here, where would we put them all? And they don't tithe. They don't have any money. They're not valuable to me. What we need, the ideal thing, would be to have a really small church of really rich people. Not a lot of problems. Bills are paid. It's perfect. But he says, you think that these people are just to be marginalized because you don't see them as being wealthy. But he said, it shows that you don't know the heart of God because the Lord is his refuge. God is the one who will come to the defense of the person who is struggling. And then this prayer in verse 7, oh, that the salvation of Israel would come out of Zion. And it will. This verse is looking forward to the Messiah coming. When the Lord brings back the captivity of his people, let Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad. It's foolish to live like there isn't a God. And one of the quickest ways to show that you don't really think there's a God is if you treat his people like dirt, if you treat his people like they don't matter. To do that betrays an atheistic heart, ultimately, practically speaking. But God will always defend those who are hurt. Ultimately, he's on their side. And so how desperately it is we need for Messiah to come and make things right. Because in this world, we don't see a lot of justice. We don't see that the scales are always balanced. God has ways of dealing with things now. And yet, ultimately, it's eternity that's the real answer. It's his return that will ultimately fix it all. Psalm 15, we looked over two Sundays ago. So if you weren't here, you can get that tape. The basic psalm is asking the question, who can camp out with God? Who can sojourn or dwell in his tent? Who will be at home in his holy hill? That is, who can spend an eternity with him? It's basically a question of what does it take to be close to God? What does it take to know God and to be in fellowship with him? And he goes through and says, part of it's walking uprightly, literally walking in integrity, consistency, reality, being complete, not being a phony, working righteousness, putting your effort into doing the right thing, speaking the truth in your heart, being honest with yourself and with God. That will always come out. If you fool yourself, there's no hope for how you'll treat others. And then he, in a negative sense, the one who doesn't backbite with his tongue, saying things behind people's backs to hurt their reputation, nor does evil or does things to hurt their neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend, not only attacking a friend, but listening to what other people have to say in a critical way about your friend. A person who does this, they see vile people as vile. And they honor those who fear the Lord. They aren't respecters of persons. If they swear to their own hurt, they'll do it anyway. Whether if they give their word, they'll keep their word, in other words, even if it doesn't work out well for them. Not taking advantage of other people and loaning out money in order to take advantage of people, or not taking a bribe. And there in the end of verse 5, he who does these things shall never be moved. This psalm, I love it. It's a formula for having a life that's stable and consistent and a guarantee that God will be with you. If you're feeling like, man, God's been a long ways away from me, it's a good list to go over to see if maybe some bitterness has crept in or some duplicity or something else that God says, you don't live in my tent. You won't spend eternity with me if you're this kind of a person. And so just looking through this list, it's one that I try to read over often, and it convicts me many times of a lot of these areas.
You're listening to The Balanced Word with our pastor and teacher, Dave Rolfe. We're going through the Psalms, and stay with us for more teaching from Pastor Dave in just a moment. These programs are available by podcast at thebalancedword.com. Thebalancedword.com. We'd also like to offer you Pastor Dave's Through the Bible series on a USB thumb drive for a gift of $20 or more. Go through the Bible with Dave by ordering this special series today. Call 949-362-7475 or go to thebalancedword.com. Your gifts help to make these shows possible on stations like this one all across the nation. Thank you for standing with us with either a one-time gift or ongoing monthly support. Donations can be made at thebalancedword.com or again call 949-362-7475. Have you had a chance to listen to Pastor Dave's one-minute messages? You can listen to those at thebalancedword.com and even join our mailing list so we can deliver them to you each day. You can also watch them on Instagram or Facebook by following CC Pacific Hills. We'd love to have you join us for a Sunday service at Pacific Hills Calvary Chapel. Our service times on Sunday morning are at 8 and 10. Directions and more information about the church can be found online at ccpacifichills.org. And you can watch our live stream there too, ccpacifichills.org. If we can pray for you in any way, we ask that you contact us through thebalancedword.com or by calling us at 949-362-7475. We have a few minutes remaining, so let's dig into Psalm 16 and hear what it has to say to us.
Now Psalm 16, another psalm of David, and he's crying out, "Preserve me, O God, for in you I put my trust. O my soul, you have said to the Lord, 'You are my Lord. My goodness is nothing apart from you.' As for the saints who are on the earth, they are the excellent ones in whom is all my delight. Their sorrows shall be multiplied who hasten after another God. Their drink offerings of blood I will not offer, nor take up their names on my lips." He's struggling with himself. David often in the Psalms talks to himself and says, "Oh, my soul." Talking to yourself can cause people around you to be concerned if you're doing it when others are around. But it's a good thing to do, to just give yourself a talk and remind yourself of what you've promised. It's why I believe when God speaks to you in a certain area, there's a real benefit in writing down what you intend to do. Writing down your commitment to the Lord and then looking back at that. If you do that in a journal or if you do it in the back of your Bible or if you do it on a piece of paper and you save it, it's being able to go back and say, "Look, here's what I said." It's sort of the idea when we get married of why we have witnesses there, because you're making all these grandiose promises. And when times get tough, it helps to have someone remind you of what you said you'd do. That's why the witnesses are there. And so often, also, we need to witness to ourselves. You know, when God is speaking, that we can look back on it and go, "Wow." I came across recently something that I wrote back in 1994, and it was the goals that I had for the coming year in a lot of different areas of my life, things that I really wanted to work on. Now, some of those things, I can really say over the last 12 years that I've really made some progress, and it made me feel kind of good to see what God was telling me back then and what I'm seeing in my life now. But a lot of the stuff, I was going, "Man, this is what I would write today." And it's, if you write it down and put it away somewhere, you forget it, then you can't talk to yourself. But it's good to remind yourself of what God has done and what you've committed to him. And so that's kind of what David is doing here, reminding himself also of the folly of falling away from God. And then he goes on in verse 5 to say, "O Lord, you are the portion of my inheritance and my cup. You maintain my lot. The lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. Yes, I have a good inheritance." I've never really inherited anything that I can think of, but there are some people who've inherited huge amounts of money, and I have some friends who stand to inherit money eventually. Kind of takes the pressure off. You don't worry quite so much about your bills because you know there's this inheritance coming, and you'll be able to pay off your bills. It's not a big deal. Well, David saw God as his inheritance, and God can do anything. And he is so powerful and so loving and so good that he didn't really have to worry. He knew in his head, didn't need to worry if God was the one who was truly his possession, ultimately his inheritance. And the truth is, we are all who know Jesus Christ, we're all just ridiculously wealthy. God has been good to us here, that's for sure. But ultimately, we're sitting on this inheritance, this promise of God that he will always take care of us, and that someday we will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. We are blessed, we are wealthy, and David is noticing that. "You are the portion of my inheritance." Reminds us of when Abraham had to rescue Lot. Lot was in Sodom, and there were some kings that were attacking Sodom, and Lot came to his defense. You know, God gave him the strength, and he had victory over these kings and chased them off. And at that point, the leaders of Sodom offered to give Abraham a huge reward. And Abraham turned it down. He said, "You know, if I'm going to be rich, I want God to make me rich. I don't want you to make me rich." And then after the guys left, he started thinking, "What did I just do?" And so he cried out to God and said, "God, Do you want me to be rich? Is there, what are you going to do for me? Look what I did. I know this was the right thing. I turned down this wealth. Now, what are you going to do for me? And God said, Abraham, I am your shield and your exceeding great reward. They have money, but you get me. And that's so much better.
We'll cover some more ground in the Psalms tomorrow on The Balanced Word with Dave Rolf. This program is presented by Pacific Hills Calvary Chapel in Aliso Viejo.
Wake up my soul. Wake up early in the day. Wake up my hands and the instrument I play. Wake up my